session number 21649, Rule 4.
Frank Hayes, Rule 4.
It is made very explicit that the order for exercise, open fire, would be given, and under no circumstances was anybody to press the trigger. The base staff were giving the orders. They oversaw the provision of the ammunition. I had turned my back from the guns when I heard a chattering noise, which sounded to me very much like an Ehrlichan being fired. And lo and behold, it was. It was fired across the other side of the dock, and I have never seen anybody descend a ladder so quickly as the crane man, crane driver, on that side of the dock.
Where was this?
In Boston, in Lincolnshire. I believe that the rounds fell somewhere in a field in just outside Boston. Person who actually fired was a stoker who had no experience of the gun at all, but we worked on the basis that the actual gunner would be killed and somebody else would have to operate it. And in this way we probably had four different people firing or pretending to fire each of the two Ehrlichans. What happened, I don't know, but instead of having dummy ammunition, live ammunition was loaded. But this was the responsibility of the base staff, not mine. And we were in real trouble. I managed to persuade them that it was possible to knock off the safety catch on the Ehrlichan by grabbing at the handles. They said, no, it was totally impossible. So I had to give them a practical demonstration as to how it was possible to do this, something I'd never tried before. And I was highly delighted when the very first attempt I made, I knocked off the safety catch and was able to, I would have been able to fire the gun. And we were completely exonerated in the end from any trouble because I had managed to demonstrate three times in succession that it was possible to knock off the safety catch with the thumb when you dived for the handles. And we didn't have any great problems with that. However, on our journey round the coast to Portsmouth, one of our two engines failed to operate. Broke down, in other words. And we had to go in to the dockyard to have a replacement engine fitted. Paxman Ricardo, if I remember right, the diesel. Didn't know when we arrived in Portsmouth that we were only a week away from D-Day. So we were hoping that we'd have our engine repaired in time. Indeed, it allegedly was. But as far as I was concerned, I was very disappointed because the skipper, Frank Willoughby, was taken away from LCT 1126, the only really experienced person in the boat. I was given another captain, whose name at the moment actually had just disappeared from my head.
Less experienced?
Pardon?
Less experienced?
Much less experienced. A very poor ship handler. And not a very nice man. He had worked for Cadbury's, I believe, in Africa, and he seemed to have some sort of notion that the crew were at his beck and call, like his blacks had been in Africa. Not a very good situation. However, we got instructions then for D-Day, and we were given these blasted pills to take, which were supposed to keep you awake if you felt drowsy, and we were advised to issue them to the crew on an experimental basis beforehand to see what their reaction would be. I remember one stoker, he took his pill and immediately started banging his head on the mast. That was the effect that they had on him. We had to get rid of him to take on somebody in his place. We moved from there to join our flotilla and squadron in Stoke Bay, which was just around the corner, really. And there we took on our contingent of the 3rd British Infantry Division, whom we had not met before, unlike the rest of the members of the flotilla. They had worked with them in practice for some time.
Which regiment did they come from?
Well, there were various people. You had engineers, and basically the way these people were packaged was you had some infantry and some engineers, somebody in a tank, etc., etc., so that when you sat down on the beach, they all, the tanks linked up together and the infantry linked up together, hopefully. And the plans all fell into line. Sometimes they didn't. There we are. However, I can remember this, the business of the people embarking. They weren't very keen. They tended to be seasick almost as soon as they stepped on board, and then to be told that the departure was to be delayed for at least 24 hours was a bit unnerving. But a sight I shall never ever forget is of the Solent appearing to have stepping stones all the way across. Marvellous armada of ships, it really was something unbelievable. And the fact that we were unmolested by enemy aircraft is surely a tremendous tribute to the Air Force and to the planners. We duly set off in the early hours of the what time was it now? Do you know, I can't honestly recall the actual time of departure. It was just an experience to start moving out from the Solent and then test guns and then set off across the channel through the marked channel in between the buoys. I can remember arriving at the meeting or dispersal point, really, across the channel, and then I can remember that we were sent. I think that they changed our instructions, and we in fact finished by being the extreme left-hand craft in the entire invasion. We were within yards of the mouth of the River Orne, and we soon discovered that we were being fired on by, I don't know, I've never been able to discover yet, I'm fairly certain that they were anti-tank guns at the mouth of the River Orne. I do know that we were also fired on by a heavy machine gun from a tower directly opposite. My principal job as first lieutenant there was to make certain that the door went down at the right time. The captain having ensured that we were far enough up the beach for it to present a proper angle, and a minimum of water for the army to wade through. But this business of being fired on by anti-tank guns was not very clever. We had about eight hits.
Whereabouts?
On the port side. They entered the hull of the ship, went through the wing tank, and in some cases they went through three lots of plating. And one of them came straight through, and it came through the side of a jeep, an army jeep, which belonged to the ambulance people. And there was a corporal sitting with his legs dangling over the side of the vehicle, ready for manoeuvring off. And apparently this shell penetrated the gearbox, went straight through that, and went straight through the fleshy part of his left, no, can't remember which leg now, went through the fleshy part of his leg, and there was profuse blood oozing out all over the place. And I can remember that we got a sheet and tore it in pieces and stuffed it into the hole and wound it round whilst we tried to get proper medical attention for him. I never know to this day whether he survived. Never know. Anyhow, the scene presented to us was most confusing. As I say, we were the extreme left hand. On the beach, there were burning tanks, particularly sort of flail tanks and that sort of thing, which had got ashore but had probably gone up on mines or been hit by anti-tank weapons, I don't know. There were bodies on the beach, and at the top of the beach, I think there were slit trenches in the sand dunes. Behind that was obviously a road, and then the buildings of the town of Wistrom. So we were in the right spot, no question about that. The thing to do was to persuade the troops to leave the tank landing craft and go ashore. I saw the first man go ashore with a padre, with a portable communion table, and he walked up the beach. That. The next person to go was an Irishman in the Provo Corps, and he had his own personal Tommy gun. And I remember him dashing off the craft, shouting at the top of his voice, and getting to the top of the beach, where it was almost as though he had taken a spade to dig out the Germans in the slit trench. They came out with their hands held high, and I thought to myself, oh, bugger, I'd better load my revolver, because we'll have to take these people back as prisoners. I recall walking into the wing tank, where the winding gear was for the door, loaded my revolver and came out, and my revolver pointed from my hip as I went to put it in the holster. And immediately there was a roar of engines, and all of our vehicles suddenly went ashore. Now, quite interesting that some years later, the man who was then my captain was in Brighton at some function, and the brigadier whom we had carried on board saw him there and said, "You know, old chap, I never forget you're number one." "Why's that?" "Well," said, "the way he came out and threatened to shoot the chaps if they didn't go ashore." I found this a little bit horrifying, because I'd no such intention. It was just that I came out with my revolver in what appeared to be a menacing position. And that did induce them, or imbue them, with a desire to leave the tank landing craft, and off they shot up the beach. What happened to them again, I will never ever know, I suppose. When we came to leave the beach, we found ourselves in trouble, because the other engine was malfunctioning. So we had one repaired engine and the other one malfunctioning. So instead of being able to return to the UK as we anticipated, if we survived, we had to contact the headquarters ship, which instructed us to repair the engine as quickly as possible, if possible, and then, having done so, to tell them, and they would give us further orders. The ERA and his staff did excellent work, did get the engine to function to a degree, and we asked for instructions. And over the next month, we were allocated various jobs, including providing anti-torpedo netting, or anti-torpedo protection around HMS Warspite, because it was believed that German midget submarines were operating in the area.
How could an LCT do that?
Quite simply by accepting the torpedo before it got to the Warspite.
You mean you just circled it?
No, we were tied up alongside. And we were tied up, our position was right underneath their secondary armament. And when that was firing, it was not very funny. They broke every glass on board was broken, every bottle on board was broken. We got no sleep. But I got round the problem of no spirits being available by coming to an arrangement with the coxswain to break the neck of the rum jar. And that was not too bad. When I tried, though, bear in mind, because we had only limited provisions, that we had no fresh bread of any description, we had no fresh meat, anything like that, I did have the temerity to climb aboard the Warspite one day and ask the commander if it would be possible for them to let us have, for example, a few loaves of bread, because we were living on ship's biscuits. The response which I got from him was, "Good God, man, we can scarcely provide enough bread for our own people, never mind you people." We were not very happy with that response, which was in marked contrast to that which we got from the many merchant ships alongside which we later from alongside which later we picked up our troops and supplies. We were not happy with the Warspite. We got all kinds of jobs to do. For example, we had to steam up the opposite end of the invasion and rescue a tank landing craft which was under bombardment by German shore batteries. We got there, we found that practically, well, I think everybody on board was shell-shocked, and undoubtedly were being shelled, and they're still being shelled, and we went for them. But when I asked what was the matter, I was told that their steering was out of action. And I did remind the captain that you could steer perfectly well with two engines, one going ahead and the other astern. And he said, oh, I'd forgotten about that. And we had to haul them off.
Which ship was this?
Pardon?
Which ship was this?
It was a tank landing craft. I'm not going to give its number. I was very, very sorry, actually, about that. But clearly they were badly affected by the shelling. There's no doubt about that. But we sort of hauled them away, even though we'd only got one decent engine.
Whereabouts did this occur?
Sorry?
Whereabouts did this occur?
Just off the coast at the other end of the landings. I can't remember the actual point. We got all kinds of comic things to do. We were asked experimentally to tie up alongside Mulberry when that was actually built. We saw the block ships arrive and be sunk and so forth. We saw the whole of that operation. We used to have to go alongside merchant vessels every day, at night time as well, and take troops down scrambling nets on board. We took the staff of the first our first base hospital ashore there. The point at which we put them down, I don't know, but we made one point of the beach our personal landing area, because we had worked out the tides and we knew exactly where we could put people down dry shod. Now, I recall when we took the staff from the hospital ashore, we'd given them a few gins before they went, and I did promise them a dry landing. I was horrified when the beachmaster there told us not to use our normal spot, we had to go somewhere else. And when we put the door down there, the beach was all at the wrong angle, as we knew it would be, and I should think the army had to go through about 2 feet of water. I remember the brigadier turning round and shaking his bloody fist. He said, "You bugger," he said, "when you come," he said, "I did invite you to the hospital," he said, "when you came next time." I said, "when you come," he said, "I'll take your bloody belly out." That was it. And it wasn't our fault that the landing was made in those circumstances. It was the beachmaster's. And we were over there for a month. We were there when Churchill and Eisenhower came over. We did receive a congratulatory message from them because we rescued the crew of a small oil tanker which sank very close to us.
Can you tell me about that?
Not a lot, because suddenly there was this bang. The next minute there were lots of smoke and oil pouring over the water, and these chaps in the water, and we were about the nearest vessel to it, so we sort of dragged them on board. Not easy to do when the people concerned are absolutely smothered in oil, as they were. But we did take him on board, and that was that. I think after about a month, we actually left there to come back to the side for various repairs. And remember, we were towing an RAF air sea rescue launch whose engine was not operating. And that was astern of us. And skipper at that time, he was complaining badly of his eye problem. I can remember he was on the bridge, and I can remember it being foggy, and I had gone down below to bring up some of the marvellous self-heating cocoa, which the army left with us on D-Day. I remember I was just about to climb the ladder to go back up to the bridge with this cocoa, when there was an almighty thump, and what we had run into was one of the tugs towing the Pluto pipeline across. And they had a V-shaped, looked like railway lines, like railway lines ahead, with a sort of bell thing which would vibrate and hopefully detonate any acoustic mines. And in the fog, we ran into each other. I don't know whose fault it actually was. Everybody on board blamed the skipper because of his eyesight. They put a huge hole in us. We got back from there to Shoreham, I think it was, yes.
When you were doing that testing at Mulberry Harbour,
yes,
was that to test whether it worked or not?
Yes, to a degree it was. They wanted to see if when we came alongside that the thing was floating up and down properly at the different states of the tide, you see.
And did it?
Yes, it did. It's very good. Some marvellous work that thing operated. Absolutely fantastic.
What did you and the rest of the crew think of that job where you were protecting the wasp bite?
We disliked it intensely. Disliked it intensely. Because we were very vulnerable. We were not appreciated for what we were doing.
How long were you doing it for?
I can't recall exactly.
Days or hours or?
Oh, it was days. Yeah. We weren't drowned all the time. It was only at night time we had to go there, you see.
Can I talk about D-Day again?
Yes.
Do I understand that the soldiers were very reluctant to disembark?
Understandably, yes. Because there was so much confusion. Ahead there were dead and dying on the beach, there were dead and dying vehicles on the beach. Ahead of that, at the top of the beach you had Germans in the trenches. Behind them there were vehicles obviously which had left other landing craft. To our right, to our starboard side, and which were moving along that road. God knows where any German vehicles were, I've no idea. And then we also had these heavy machine guns firing directly at the beach. We actually put that heavy machine gun firing at us out of action with our Oerlikon. We gave them a couple of three blasts and it just disappeared. It's a very, very confusing situation. They were reluctant to go ashore, not because they were cowards, not at all, but because they wondered whether what they saw ahead of them was quite what they'd seen in the plans, I think. I think they expected to be able to go off the beach just like that, but it wasn't quite so easy.
About how long were they before they disembarked?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. Certainly, I would think, something like 20 minutes to half an hour. But it was not due to cowardice. That was just, is this a good spot to be?
And all